I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congressman Ed Markey, chair of the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, is calling for oil companies to chip in up to $50 million a year to pay for developing better oil spill safety and cleanup. But residents of tiny Magnolia Springs, Alabama, population 1,000, are not waiting. Let's start there today. The Unified Command, the consortium of federal agencies and BP officials, suggested that booms be stretched across the 600-foot mouth of Weeks Bay, which leads into a 6,000-acre estuary. But residents of Magnolia Springs felt that waves would just carry the oil over the booms, so they came up with their own plan. James Hinton, a volunteer fire chief, is leading their effort. James, we're going to have a map of the area at our website, herenow.org, but I'm looking at it, and at Alabama, Mobile Bay sticks up from the Gulf like a big left-hand mitten, and Weeks Bay is the thumb sort of jutting off to the right that juts into your little town. Why is this bay important?
Well, these rivers are prime estuary and a habitat. This is where the majority, a lot of the fish and the shrimp that people enjoy for table fare, this is where they grow up. This is where they come to reproduce, the fish and the shrimp, along with, we've got endangered species here. We've got bald eagles in the area and also ospreys in the area, which are on the endangered species list, and not to mention some of the native habitat, a pitcher plant bog. It's a carnivorous plant, kind of like the Venus flytrap.
Wow, a pitcher plant bog, right.
It's native to South Alabama, and it's one of very few that are in existence in the country.
Well, so you had this idea in May, seeing this oil slick heading from Louisiana across the Gulf, to stop oil from seeping into this estuary. You've started to implement it this past weekend. What have you done?
Like I've said before, this is not rocket science. It's not engineering. There's no calculus involved or anything else. We had a group of people, of community people, that we all gathered in kind of a small community meeting the 1st of May and started brainstorming ideas of what we could do. The idea we settled on was the barge idea.
Barges, huge barges that you've pulled across the entrance to Weeks Bay?
Right. Well, they're not huge barges, but they're 120-foot barge, so they're a good-sized barge. They're called spud barges, kind of like a potato, because there's big metal pipes that come off these barges, and they're driven into the sea floor.
And then you've put boom behind the barges.
That's right.
So that they're sort of a second stop gap, and the barges might stop the waves, and the boom then stop
the oil. That's exactly right. And it was quite amazing. We all saw the fruits for Labor Sunday night when we had that 2.5-foot wave action out in the bay. And the water behind the barges was as smooth as a swimming pool.
Well, a couple questions for you. First of all, you've left an opening in the barges so that boats can go in and out, we understand, because you still haven't gotten permission from the Unified Command. This links all the parties from BP through the government agencies and approves responses in federal waters. You know, they have to give you approval to completely seal off this bay. And you told the New York Times that you could actually go to jail for, you know, you yourself for instigating this without permission. Do you plan on closing this, sealing this bay off completely if you see the oil coming, even if you don't have approval?
That's correct. We're not going to wait. Louisiana's already been lost, and I'm not risking that here. You know, I don't want to defy anybody or anything else, but if it comes down to it, we'll shut it down ourselves. We'll ask for forgiveness later.
Well, you not only watched Louisiana, but booms were strung across Mobile Bay. And again, if you picture a big snow mitt, Mobile Bay is the whole mitt. The bay you're protecting is the thumb. But booms that were strung across Mobile Bay were shredded by water. So you feel your idea of barges is the better one. We understand this is going to cost you about $150,000 to keep this in place for 3 weeks. Right now you have a $200,000 grant that came from BP earlier to your community. How do you keep this going?
We're going to keep it going any way we can between the town and the fire department, which we're both limited on funding, but we'll find funding sources. We're determined people. We didn't get to this point without being determined, and I hope BP will do the right thing and continue the funding, because you're right, it's $159,000 in 3 weeks is what it's costing. We're We're being required by the Coast Guard to keep the tugboat on site with an operator 24/7 since we deployed the barges, and that's the majority of the cost, paying that crew plus the barge rental, which we're having to do. But one way or the other, we're going to keep it going.
Well, now, the oil hasn't come yet. You still don't know if this is going to work. I mean, your hope is that it will. Environmentalists, critics of absorbent booms say they just soak up oil and then they sink to the bottom and could be lost, filled with oil down at the bottom of the ocean and be more dangerous. But also, do you worry that you may be somehow disturbing the ecology, the flow into the estuary, and not even know it?
It's a possibility, but do we disturb it for 6 months or a year or however long we have to? Or do we let the oil disturb it for 100 years and destroy it? You know, we're just putting our best foot forward.
James Hinton, a volunteer fire chief in Magnolia Springs, Alabama, spearheading a citizen effort to keep the oil from making its way into Weeks Bay there in Alabama. James, best of luck to you.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you for all you do.
Well, on the Today Show this morning, President Obama gave an extended interview during which he was asked if he allowed himself to imagine what the Gulf region would look like if the BP well spews until August. The president said it will be a mess, but he felt there was also a resiliency in the people and the place.
There are going to be marshes, for example, where the oil goes in and the sea life that's there is decimated for a season, maybe two. But potentially we can preserve those estuaries and those marshes so that 3 years from now, things have come back, things have bounced back.
Well, our next guest is not as optimistic. Julia Witte covers the environment for Mother Jones. She's also author of the upcoming book, Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. We've spoken to her in the past about discovering vast underwater dead zones with no oxygen and floating garbage hairballs the size of football fields. She's been spending time in the marshes of Louisiana. Julie, what did you see there?
The oil is coming in and getting soaked up into the marshes very quickly. Obviously, it's oiling the wildlife. We can only see a fraction of what's being oiled. Some of the birds that are getting hit, others being lost out in the marshes, and who knows what's going on down below. Obviously, underwater, the effects are going to be devastating.
Well, just first of all, how bad is the oil? I mean, we're seeing some images. It almost looks like chocolate syrup. You know, people step in it or boats run through it, and it just coats the feet and boat. You know, how does this compare to other oil you might have seen?
This looks rustier than some of the other things, but it's hard to tell what's been hit with dispersant and what's changed colors. I've seen parts of it that's very dark brown, shiny, and then parts that are a rusty red color. I don't know what effect weather, time, and dispersant are having on the oil itself.
Well, and you, in one of your tweets, you refer to it as almost a hospice wilderness. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, coming down here, I have this feeling as I move around through these beautiful marshlands, really some of the most stunningly beautiful places I've ever seen, and I have the feeling I'm with a terminally ill patient. I can't shake that feeling that this is a doomed ecosystem. I think it will probably be pretty hard to ever recover to what it was. I think it may never be the same, certainly the marshes. Somebody recently said that on a scale of 1 to 10, the effects of oil on a beach are a 3, but the effects of oil on marshes is a 10.
And remind us why.
Because there's no way we know how to clean them. With a beach, you can just go in and scrape it down to the bone, and in comes the next layer of sand and whatnot. But marshes, it's actually getting incorporated into the muck and the mud. How do you clean out a marsh? And one of the things I've been very struck with moving around down here by boat is how enormous this place is and how it's like being in a labyrinth of islands and sedges and grasses, and there's no way we could even get in there to reach those without destroying them. We, in fact, don't really know how to clean oil out of marshes.
Why don't we? You know, it's not like we didn't know that rigs were off the coast of a marsh.
I know that during the Amoco Cadiz spill off France in 1978, they tried scraping the marshes, like scraping them down to kind of ground level or root level, and apparently the vast majority of those marshes never came back. There's talk of burning the marshes here, and I know they did some burning post-Katrina when there was a fair amount of oil spill in the marshes here from the hurricane. And I don't actually know, I haven't been able to track down yet whether or not that was effective. Have those marshes come back? Did they change? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, and we've been saying it over and over again, but it bears repeating. Why do we care so much about marshes?
These marshes here in southern Louisiana are really fueling the entire Gulf of Mexico. It's nursery grounds and breeding grounds for fish and shrimp and lots of invertebrate life. These are important stopover places on migratory routes for birds that are going to come up to New England, that are going to go on to Canada, that are going to Latin America, Central and South America. So this entire hemisphere really is going to be impacted by this spill.
Well, you know, right now there are birds nesting, but isn't the nature of things that more will be planning to migrate through that area?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a terrible time for the spill as it is because there's so much breeding activity going on right now. All the birds are breeding. And, of course, once they're finished breeding, an awful lot of them are going to be migrating. So even right now, all the birds that have gone up into the Arctic regions to do their nesting, a lot of them will be coming down this what's called the Mississippi Flyway. It's one of the major migratory routes for North American and South American birds, many of them stopping over in the marshes of southern Louisiana to refuel before they cross the Gulf of Mexico. And a lot of them aren't going to ever leave. They're going to get here, they're going to be poisoned, and they're going to die. And that birds that you might expect to see next year or people in Latin America might expect to see later this year, they're not going to see them.
Well, and that's the wildlife. By the way, there have been some dead dolphins washing up on the beaches there, but not huge numbers. And some reports have said that's because the spill is so far out to sea that it doesn't impact mammals and large birds as much. Is that true?
We don't know what's going on out there, and we don't know who's dying out there, frankly. We have the problem with this spill is that it's contaminating the entire water column from 3,000 or more feet deep, from 5,000 feet deep to the surface, and it's circulating in currents throughout the entire basin of the Gulf of Mexico and maybe beyond. First of all, even if the animals aren't directly getting hit by oil, there's a very good chance that they're beginning to consume things that have themselves consumed things that have either been exposed to oil or to the dispersants, which are very toxic. So whether or not they die immediately of, say, oil on their feathers, we may well be setting up for a system where they're going to be dying in short order from basically being poisoned.
Well, and that means that they might make it to the red list. This is compiled by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources. It's the list of species that have been scientifically assessed and categorized from least concern about their future to near threatened, vulnerable, endangered, critically endangered, extinct. And you write 1 in 5 mammals, 1 in 8 birds, 1 in 3 amphibians, reptiles, corals, fish, conifers, and other cone-bearing trees are already teetering towards extinction.
I think we need to understand how many species that we take somewhat for granted that we know about are actually in trouble in one form or another. This is already a gulf that's on the brink, it's on the edge, and now we add this enormous insult to it, and it really becomes debatable. This is why I say I feel like I'm in the presence of a terminally ill patient.
That's Julia Whitty, environmental correspondent for Mother Jones in the Gulf, covering the oil disaster. When we come back, the government is now confirming those deep sea oil plumes that BP denies. We'll find out where they are, but also get Julia's opinion. What's their impact? That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with journalist Julia Whitty. She's in New Orleans covering the oil disaster for Mother Jones. And Julia, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is now confirming what scientists have been saying, which is that there are underwater oil plumes, and they're now as far as 142 miles away from the leaking well. As we said, BP had questioned whether there was oil in these plumes. So first, your thoughts on that denial, but also the damage from these deep sea plumes.
Yeah, I don't understand why BP continues to try to hide what everyone can very clearly see is going on out here. I think it's backfiring terribly. You don't have to spend a week down here to figure out how angry people are at the fact that they will not come clean and tell the truth. That aside, the fact is that this is a somewhat different oiling than we've had, for instance, up in Valdez, because we are contaminating from the bottom up. So in the deep layer of the ocean contains the most biomass. It's known as the deep scattering layer, and it's a layer of life that's full of fish and squid and everything you could ever imagine that live below the cusp of perpetual darkness.
Wait, the cusp of perpetual darkness.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah, what is that?
That means they never come up into daylight. They never come up into sunlit sea. So at night, when the sun sets and the layer of darkness goes up to the surface, they may in fact rise to the surface. But during the daylight hours, they stay below twilight in the ocean. So they're down very deep, below 1,000 or more feet. What we think of as a rich surface ocean is truly the tip of the iceberg. The vast amount of life is going on down in those deeper layers of the ocean. And those deeper layers are what feed the surface animals that we know and love, the birds and the sea mammals and turtles and so on. Most of those guys are going out and diving. An awful lot of them are diving in and meeting the deep scattering layer as it rises up towards the surface at night. Now we have that entire world poisoned with oil and dispersant like never before. We don't know what the long-term effects of that can be, but you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know it can't be good.
Yeah. Do you see any encouraging signs? We know you were speaking about how the power of the Mississippi might actually keep oil away from shore in some places.
Being down here, I'm looking for those little moments of hope, and one thing was to realize that the marshes at the very mouth of the Mississippi River so far have not been oiled, and in its all likelihood it's because the outflow of water from this mighty river is actually pushing back and keeping the oil offshore. Well, that seems like, it just seemed fantastic to me. And then in the midst of these oiled and destroyed beaches, I find little tiny lease terns are still nesting and still hanging on to trying to raise their little fragile chicks. And the truth is, perhaps none of them will survive, but maybe a few will, and that's the hope, because that's how we start again in the aftermath of disaster. Sometimes we start from only a handful of individuals.
Julia Whitty, what do you say to critics who say, you know, this probably seems too impossible to grasp on one level, but on another level, it does sound like Chicken Little, and they think, well, you know, we're all still living after Exxon Valdez. Or they would say in your book, for instance, the portion that's about living in Isla Rasa with all these terns and gulls, there's also peregrine falcons who missile in, you know, and take out the most vulnerable of the birds. And, you know, some would say, well, man is sort of like that, that this is part of nature. You know, I'm playing devil's advocate here. What do you say to them?
Well, I think the better analogy would be something like a really virulent pathogen coming through. And in a very short time, we've risen up to become this enormously powerful force on the planet. And we are basically acting like a disease in that we're wiping out vast amounts of life and destroying entire ecosystems, reducing the ecosystem services that all these life forms provide that keep our planet livable. So it's in fact very dire, and people who understand science and they see our future when you combine all of these problems is not very good, and these things individually might not be a problem, but when you combine them, it becomes just intolerable. And so we do have ahead of us the need to figure out a way to live sustainably on this planet, or all these problems that only seem to be affecting people locally in the Gulf will come home to all of us.
What is the government, BP, what is not being done in the cleanup or stoppage process that you'd like to see?
I don't actually know what they can do. My sense is that some of what they're doing now is possibly more detrimental than not. I don't actually think that putting out these booms, these booms that float at the surface, probably has much, if any, effect. Certainly the dispersant, I'd like to see that stopped immediately. We do not know the effects. We don't know enough about the effects. And what we do know about that Corexit is it's not good. And why should we compound the problem of oil with yet some other toxin? So I think the first thing to do would be to stop that. And I think the reason they're doing that is it breaks up the oil and it makes it look like there's less of a spill, but I don't think it actually solves the problem and it's compounding it.
It might mean that less oil washes up on shores, on beaches, but it's doing terrible things in the ocean itself.
Yeah, and it's also coming ashore, the dispersants.
Right.
I mean, it's not staying out there either. So it's another form of toxin that's coming into shoreside and offshore environments we already know about one toxin. Why do we want two of them out there? What's the point of that?
What about sand berms? We've been back and forth on this debate. There are some ecologists that feel that to build these big berms along Louisiana's shore would, first of all, reduce the already eroding coastline of sand, but then also that oil would just go right over the berms.
Yeah, oil's going to go over in this first little bit of a storm. I mean, if they really want to talk about rebuilding sand at the mouth of the Mississippi River, then they should free up the mouth of the river. Right now it's essentially a canal that's coming out. Break down the walls of some of that canal and let the Mississippi, which is the thing that builds that delta, carry its own silt from all those upper 48 states and carry it down and back out into the Gulf. That flushing action would be more useful to rebuilding a disappearing delta than anything else.
That's Julia Whitty. She's long covered the environment for Mother Jones magazine. She's been on the program before. We'll link you to previous conversations. She's also author of the upcoming book, Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. And she's been speaking to us from the Gulf. Julie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
When soccer fans go to Cape Town, South Africa this week for the World Cup, they'll be warned about thieves who may break into their cars or confront them on the road. And no matter what, these tourists will be told, never, ever feed them. That's because these thieves are wild baboons who roam Cape Town's hills and have become relentless in their pursuit of food people eat. They're considered pests and have been poisoned, whipped, shot. But one woman is trying to change public opinion about baboons, and producer Diane Toomey went on a baboon walk with her.
When you head into baboon country, you need to clear it with the big guy on the block. And in the Cape Town suburb of Glencane, that would be Georgie. Georgie is the alpha male who rules a troop of about three dozen baboons who roam the hills here. Our tour guide, Spello Minnelli, calls out to the 100-pound animal as if to get his okay for our small group to come closer. Georgie stares down from his perch on a rock above us.
He's a very big boy. He's got an amazingly large head.
Jenny Trethowen heads up the organization that runs these tours. It's called Baboon Matters.
And you can see George just sort of gazing over his domain. Around us, we can see lots of little family groups where they are just resting fast asleep or else grooming each other.
Trethowen used to be, as she puts it, just a housewife. But 20 years ago, she became a baboon activist when a troop of baboons was killed after one too many encounters with local suburbanites. She formed her organization and hired men from nearby townships to act as guards who herd baboons away from town. The system worked, but Trethowen says she wanted to do more. She wanted people to see a kinder, gentler baboon up close.
Everybody thought I was completely mad and that nobody would want to come and walk with baboons.
Trethowen tells me about some advice she got from one of her guards.
And he said to me, whenever you come to the baboons, you must talk to them and tell them your intention. So I climbed up on the rock, and I sat next to Georgie, and I said, hello, Georgie, I'm Jenny. And that was the start of our long, loving relationship.
Loving is not how you describe the relationship a lot of people in Cape Town have with baboons. These animals can be aggressive, even dangerous, when it comes to snatching food from your car, your house, or your hand. Today, we've been instructed to carry nothing edible with us, not even gum.
There's some sitting up on the tree there.
We walk farther up the hill and come to a scene that resembles the amputee ward in a war hospital.
This is the one we called Penelope, the one that is missing a hand.
Our guide, Spello, says that hand was damaged beyond repair by gunshots.
We can come this way and stay here.
It is illegal to kill baboons, but that doesn't stop some people, who Trethowen says have a shoot-on-sight policy, regardless of whether the baboon is a threat. We walk farther up the slope, where about a dozen baboons sit under small trees and bushes out of the midday sun. But not everyone is sleeping.
Okay, that is the copulation noise. So the females always make that noise when they've finished copulating. And it's a very strategic thing because it lets the others know who's mating. And the males can then keep an eye out to see that their females are not mating with somebody else inadvertently.
We're surrounded by lounging baboons. Off to one side, a young male, his long canine teeth just starting to grow in, gives an infant what can only be described as a hug. Another baboon yawns. It's a peaceful little family moment, until...
A spat broke out between the boys, and as you could see, it was over and done with very quickly. And then the noise that you heard afterwards was basically everybody just checking in with each other to see where everybody was and what was happening.
But it looks like no grudges have been held.
No grudges. It's over very quickly, and then everybody settles down.
And as the start of the World Cup approaches, Cape Town is hoping that thousands of soccer fans who will soon be flooding into the city will be as well behaved.
To see pictures of the baboons of Cape Town, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Our story was produced by Diane Toomey. When we come back, how much should we fear baboons or oil spills or anything here and now? When we read journalist David Ropeek's new book about risk, one sentence jumped out at us. He writes, environmental advocates dramatize the risk of bovine growth hormone, offshore drilling, hazardous waste sites, and mercury, all of which are risks but not nearly as dramatic as some would make them out to be. Let's back up there. Offshore drilling, not as dramatic a risk as some would make it out to be. Of course, David wrote this before the disaster in the Gulf, but it gives us a good jumping point to talk about his new book. It's called How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. David is an instructor at the Harvard University Extension School. Our listeners in the Boston area also know him from his long television career here. David, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, environmentalists might say back to you, that's the point. We know the sky isn't always falling when it comes to offshore drilling, but when something does happen, it's not just that it's more dramatic, it's disastrous.
Every summer in the Gulf of Mexico, there is a dead zone because of fertilizer runoff from up in the Mississippi that comes down and causes algae to grow, which takes the oxygen out of the water, and the size of New Jersey can't support more than single-cell organisms. Every summer.
Now, I'm not saying
the oil spill isn't a risk, but what I'm saying is that the catastrophic nature of it and some risks tend to grab our attention more, and we end up paying attention more to some than to others.
Okay, so you're not making fun of me if I also worry about those dead zones, because I do. Because what happens when you have a sentence like that, which says environmental advocates dramatize the risk of, and you have a long list, in their heads, people might also be hearing dead zones.
First of all, I'm not making fun of anybody. In fact, what the book tries to do is observe how absolutely innate it is that we perceive risks this way, that it's not rational, that it's not just about the statistics. That's nonsense. And the rationalists and the academics and the conservatives who would like it to be that way are just ignoring the evidence of how the human animal has evolved to perceive risk. We use characteristics like, is it catastrophic? Is it natural or not? Sometimes the characteristics that make something scary grab our attention, at the risk of paying less or too little attention to bigger risks.
Well, and that was going to be a question. And so in your list there, you said that conservatives also could use concerns about risk to their own benefit, because I'm thinking a very casual flip through your book, or maybe just hearing that sentence, that could be held up by an oil industry executive or Republican Rand Paul, for that matter, who feels the government's being too tough on BP, as saying in that sentence, environmental advocates are all chicken littles. You're not saying that.
No. I'm saying that we all, humans, Republicans and Democrats and conservatives and liberals and everybody, use a set of characteristics that make a risk feel more or less scary to us. We mix that in with our own underlying cultural sense of how the world should be organized. Do we like things hierarchical? Authority structures, rigid, that's conservative and Republican. Or do we like it egalitarian? There should be no class and everybody can have every opportunity. That's called egalitarian. Do we think that government should butt out? Rand Paul,
yeah.
Right? Or do we think that government should butt in? Communitarians. So where do you think those people are going to fall on climate change?
You tell me.
Well, where they're going to fall is a communitarian thinks something global is something that we all have to work on together. A libertarian is going to hate that idea. So what they're going to do is they're going to deny the problem. Son of a gun. And now we're at the position on climate change, which has nothing to do with the facts and everything to do with this underlying cultural worldview. That's what's going on. When one side said snow in Washington, D.C. is proof that there's no such thing as climate change, and the other side says the snow in Washington, D.C. is proof that there's climate change. It has nothing to do with the snow.
And where does this difference come from? Is it in our brain? Is it cultural? Where does it come from?
That's one factor among many that goes into what shapes our views on risk. Another one is it natural or not? Do I trust the communicator or not, or the government who's supposed to protect me? Is there a high degree of uncertainty? Did I choose to take the risk myself? There are these characteristics, psychological traits, if you will.
Well, for instance, let's take a look at some of your anecdotes. You observed a lot of this while a reporter. You tell of a woman at a school board meeting, among many, worried to death about something in the school.
Chemicals in the air.
Chemicals in the air. While she was what?
Way overweight and chain smoking, with her overweight daughter standing next to her breathing in the secondhand smoke.
And your point was, why is she seeing the one that is intangible and may not exist, which was the potential danger in the school, and not seeing the other that was very tangible and she was doing?
A man-made risk is scarier than a natural risk. These were man-made chemicals. A risk to your kids is going to scare you more than a risk to adults, and this was a risk to her daughter. A risk where she couldn't trust the people who were supposed to keep her safe, the superintendent of schools who had allowed these chemicals to come into the schools, is scarier than if you trusted the superintendent and the local board of health. There are characteristics that made it feel that way to her, which, if we understand them, we can see for ourselves that we're doing what that lady did, and hopefully for ourselves make healthier choices.
I was going to ask you, how do you use this information, this idea of perception gaps and people unable? Here's another one. People able to see a risk for someone else, but not for them. It's cell phones. You know, you always say, no, it's terrible. That would be dangerous for someone else to join with a cell phone, but not me.
Well, that's a perfect example on which to use to answer your question. So maybe you've had the experience where you're using your mobile phone and you're driving down the road, and I look over and there's a motorist next to me speeding up and slowing down and weaving right to the left. And that guy makes me angry. Wait a minute. I'm doing it. That doesn't make me angry? No, it doesn't, because I'm choosing to do it. And a risk you choose to take feels different than a risk that's imposed on you. Now, you ask the question, how do we use that? Ask yourself for 10 seconds here whether the fact that you're choosing it is screwing with your perception of how dangerous it is. And sometimes anymore, I don't use the phone as much in the car because I don't let the choice factor, now that I recognize it, seduce me into thinking it's not that big a deal. So what I've done is I've recognized that my perceptions can be a threat. We do have to fear itself too much or too little. That's the first step to putting on your seatbelt in life. Then the seatbelt itself are the tools that are in the book, the specific definitions of what makes one thing feel scarier than another. Can you eradicate them? No. Am I always going to be more afraid of risks to my kids than to myself? Absolutely. I'm a dad. But I can be smarter if I also understand the psychology that might be getting in the way of the healthiest choice.
That's David Ropeek. His book is How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Match the Facts. It tries to get us to look at how we look at risk, to maybe look at it differently. David, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. And before we go today, how risky is it to move into a house where a horrible murder has taken place? Boy, this is turning into a very frightening program today. Starting as it did with the Gulf spill, we're going to end with homes where murders have taken place. But if you want to hear the program again, don't forget you can always go to hereandnow.org and download a podcast. You can also, when you travel, find us on XM Sirius Radio. We'll be back in 1 minute, Here and Now. Well, a warning, our next story may be disturbing, even grisly for some of you, and it's about real estate. But it's the place where real estate intersects with murder. Take this listing on New York's Long Island. It reads, charming three-story waterfront Dutch colonial commanding beautiful views. At one point, the asking price was $1.5 million. But what the ad doesn't say is that a man murdered his entire family here while they slept, and it might be haunted. It's the former home of the DeFeo family in Amityville, New York. Sound familiar? That's where Ronald DeFeo Jr. murdered his parents and four siblings in 1974. It was the basis of the 1979 movie, The Amityville Horror. A year after the murders, George and Kathy Lutz bought the house at a cut-rate price, but say within days, things got weird.
when you hear screams at night and you hear footsteps at night and the kids are saying strange things and the temperatures in the house vary and the spots that would appear on the carpet in the morning, the progression of certain toilets turning black, the china actually turning black. When you sit down and you start talking about those, then there's obviously something wrong.
Well, that turning black thing could have been the sea breeze, but that's George Lutz from the documentary The Real Amityville Horror. He says he spent just 28 days in the house before fleeing during one final terrifying night. It's had subsequent owners, but still, would you want to live there? Real estate where really awful things happen. It's a macabre topic, as we said, but it affects a surprising number of homeowners and agents. And Nick Summers, senior writer for Newsweek, has compiled some of the stories. He joins us from WNYC in New York. Nick, start with the Amityville house. Tell us about the first sale of the house to the Lutz family.
Yeah, the Lutz family bought it in December 1975, so just more than a year after the sextuple homicide that had taken place there on November the 13th, 1974. And they bought it for $80,000, which they felt was a steal. And then there's some debate about what happened next, whether they claimed that all these spooky things happened and terrifying things, and the movie, of course, was made. But there's some pretty healthy skepticism about whether that actually happened.
Well, if they were making up the stories, it might have hurt them when they tried to sell the house.
That's right. They only sold it for $55,000, so there's still a lot of fluctuation with such a stigma attached to the property.
Yeah, and it's listed now at, what, $1.5 million?
Yeah, which is actually a big increase from 1997 when it was sold for $310,000. It's a really nice home. You know, I mean, it's waterfront property. It's got a nice boat garage and a heated pool. So there's a real potential that it could, after maybe a few more years or maybe a lot more years, it'll appreciate back to what its real value would have been.
So you say it's worth more than $1.5 million?
Well, you know, it's got a lot of amenities. You know, that's actually a common theme in these crazy murder real estate stories. You know, a lot of the murders and horrible crimes that fascinate us happen at the homes of wealthy people. It's just that's one of the ingredients.
Yeah, and you know, the listing calls it the legendary Amityville home. They're not shying away from the fact that yes, there was a movie about supposed events, but there were real murders there.
Yeah, you know, at some point, and this is a different point for everyone, I guess, the horrible thing that happened in a home can turn into an historical thing that happened in a home.
Then we're acknowledging, this is a kind of a squeamish topic, but there's the Clutter family farm. This was, of course, the farm made infamous in Truman Capote's book In Cold Blood. It's the murder of the family in 1959 in Holcomb, Kansas. There was also a film. And we understand the film was actually shot in the real home?
Yeah, the original film was shot in the home. That's a very unusual house. It's a farmhouse, so it's only 3,600 square feet, but it's on 7 acres. It was built for just $40,000. And the murders took place in 1959. In 1964, the house was purchased by a cattle rancher, and he lived there for many years, and he had no problem with them shooting the first In Cold Blood movie there. And then many years later, he committed suicide, and a local couple bought the house for just $1 and other valuable consideration. I'm assuming that they thought that eventually that it could sell for something close to its fair market value. They put the house up for private auction back in 2006 at $275,000, but they only got $100,000 for a bid, and they turned it down. And the last appraisal that I was aware of is $136,000. So that's one where there's just not a high price tag for this legendary property.
But how interesting that there was a second terrible tragedy in the house, first the murders and then a suicide.
Yeah, some property. I mean, I think it would be too much to link the two. But yeah, I mean, some houses just really can't catch a break.
Well, the next one that you look at, it's an odd one for me. Just I should disclose, I've been in the home on Cielo Drive where the Manson murders took place. Now, Sharon Tate was living at the time. It was the home of her agent, Rudy Altobelli, who also happened to be my brother's agent. He's an actor who was living in the guest house that weekend, but was away when the Manson family came. Horrible, horrible. But I remember that Rudy Altobelli subsequently moved back into the home, and he actually, you know, left some of the stains, you know, the blood stains around the house.
Gruesome.
And he lived there for decades.
Well, I guess he took the long view. You know, he knew what he was doing. He knew that enough time went by, he'd eventually get back to getting full value for the place. Now, my understanding, though, is that he actually ended up getting a pretty good price, not for the home, which was raised, but for the property itself. After a certain period of time, you know, the stigma fades. But people generally don't want to live in the actual structure where these terrible crimes happened.
Yeah.
The property is a different matter.
Nick Summers, again of Newsweek, I got to ask, what got you started on this?
Morbid curiosity, I would have to say. You know, these homes, they're generally nice properties. They come up onto the market every so often. And when they do, you know, they come with this intersection of grisly true crime and real estate. I mean, as a New Yorker, I guess I just have an interest in real estate like anybody else. And this is a particularly vicarious way to pay attention to it.
Give us some others that you looked at.
Well, another example where the home was knocked down is the Heaven's Gate Mansion. This was the home of a cult in Rancho Santa Fe, California, where 39 bodies were found in March 1997. And at the time, that house was listed at $1.6 million, a really nice property, seven bedrooms, seven baths, a limo garage, indoor sauna, pool, spa, tennis court. And obviously, after 39 bodies were found there, nobody really wanted to live in that house.
Well, this was the cult that believed that the Hale-Bopp comet meant that a vehicle, a spaceship, was coming to take them away. And they laid down and took cyanide, I believe?
Yeah, all wearing matching sneakers, if yeah. I remember correctly.
Yeah.
So in addition to the stigma that comes with a house like that, there is also approximately $100,000 worth of physical damage. So the whole thing was knocked down. Usually they'll leave a driveway or something that you can use, but in this case, every square inch of the property was just bulldozed. Every blade of grass was gone.
Yeah. This was in 1999 when the owner sold it for, you know, a fraction of what it was worth to a developer.
Yeah, almost $1 million off the price.
Well, there's Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment. Interesting because the property value actually went up after he went on his serial killer spree.
Yeah, that's a real outlier, that apartment building. He lived in a pretty unremarkable apartment building outside the campus of Marquette University in Milwaukee. And there happened to be a neighborhood revitalization ever going on where a private group was buying up blighted land and trying to get the crime in the area down. And the owner of the building where Dahmer lived and was storing human heads in his refrigerator realized that he actually had an opportunity here and he could get a little bit more out of these guys who were buying up all this land. And so he held out for a little bit and made a tiny little profit. One of the very rare examples where the price of one of these properties actually goes up.
Yeah. Nick Summers, senior writer for Newsweek. He's compiled these macabre real estate stories along with others. You can link to them at our website, hereandnow.org. Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you.